Thank you so much for the opportunity and such esteemed company to have an opportunity to present here. It's really exciting to have the public health community look at and recognize commercial sexual exploitation as a public health issue. And I'm focusing today on girls because we are a gender-specific program, but to be clear that this happens to boys and transgender youth as well. So as Deborah said, we've been operating My Life, My Choice since 2002, shortly after a young woman was murdered here in Boston in 2001. She was 17. She was living in a DCF-funded group home, so she wasn't untethered and on her own. She had folks in her life who cared about her, group home staff, a DCF worker. She had an aunt who loved her very much. But no one knew she was being controlled by a pimp and being exploited through prostitution. She was murdered as a result. And we created the program to offer a continuum of services that began with prevention. I really kind of held on to my public health roots and tried to look at what was happening in other public health issues and bring it to bear here. And through intervention services. We are based here in Boston, but serve girls throughout eastern Massachusetts. Right now we have girls as far north as Salem, Beverly, Lowell, Lawrence, down to Taunton, Brockton, Plymouth, Fall River, Attleboro, and out to Worcester, and lots of communities in between, Medfield, Lexington, Sudbury, Concord. So to begin, I just want to talk quickly about a definition of what do we think of when we're talking about the commercial sexual exploitation of children. And if you walk away with one thing from what I'm saying today, we're talking about a form of child sexual abuse. We're not talking about delinquency. We're not talking about promiscuity. We're not talking about girls gone wild. We're talking about a form of child sexual abuse. And unlike some other forms of sexual abuse, there's remuneration in the form of money, goods, or services. And I'm going to narrow it down even further and talk about within the context of the commercial sex industry. How many of you in your work have worked with either girls, boys, transgender youth, adults who have been impacted by the commercial sex industry? Can I just see a show of hands? Okay, lots of you. So when we're talking about commercial sexual exploitation of children, we're talking about all of these things. What I want to lift up is kind of the biggest change since we began this work 11 years ago, which is that the exploitation of juveniles has gone indoors. So when we started this work, we talked a lot about street outreach and finding girls on the city of Boston. And now, on a weekend night, you could go downtown, right, and you could walk around and say, we don't have a problem with prostitution of juveniles here in Boston because they're not in your face. You may see adult women exchanging sex for small amounts of money to feed an addiction, and what we know is those are our girls if they don't get out, right? It's the same population, different point in time. You will see girls on the street if there's a reason, if there's a different kind of convention at this convention center, right? There will be pimps bringing their girls to work it. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably not happening at APHA, but that can't confirm or deny that. If there's a Celtics game, if there's some reason lots of men are coming into the city of Boston, pimps will bring their girls out. But in general, our girls are sold online. Now, does anybody know what the number one website in America right now is to sell adolescent? It had been Craigslist up until a couple years ago. So it used to be you'd go on Craigslist, you'd click onto erotic services, and you could buy a person for a period of time as easy as a lawnmower. And then with a lot of pressure from advocates around the country, they changed that to adult services. And you would go on, and a page would come up, and it would say, are you really a grown-up? And you would say, yes, I am. And then you got in, right? That was their safeguard. And it was really attorney generals across the country that pushed and shut down Craigslist. What's emerged is Backpage.com. One word, Backpage. If you've never been on it, I urge you to do that. Probably not at work, probably get in trouble, but I urge you to do that and type in where you live or type in where you work, because you will see post after post after post for individuals being sold. None of them will say that they're minors, because that does get taken down, but you will see a lot at 18 years old and listed as 18. And for any of you that work with adolescents, it will take you moments to pick out the ones that are kids. It's just not hard to do. So pimps post up their girls. There's a cell phone number. She is placed in a hotel or a motel room around the city, and that is in the toniest hotels to the kind of lowest budget hotels and everything in between, suburbs, city. Girls are placed there and required, on average, our girls report having to exchange sex 10 to 20 times per night. Pimp comes by, picks up the money. And this is a scenario happening over and over again. I think of one of our girls who went missing a number of weeks ago with someone she had met in a chat room. He brought her to a hotel. He posted her up. Within a half an hour, a man was there, and he paid for her with $40 and two packs of cigarettes. It happens that quick. The other thing I just want to lift up is the nexus with gangs, because we're talking a lot about, at this conference, I know, about gun violence, street violence, and the connection. What we've learned is that in the last 5 or 6 years, that gangs have realized that in addition to it being lucrative to sell guns or drugs, right, but up until now, there have been much harsher penalties for doing that. They learn that it's much easier to sell a girl, right? The quote is that you can only sell a drug once, but you can sell a girl over and over again. What we've been fed in the last few years is less of talk around commercial sexual exploitation. When we started this work, we would beg folks to come do training, right? We train all over the country, and we train here, and we would beg, and we would say, really, this is happening. It's happening to the kids you care about. And it was hard to kind of get in the door. And in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a lot of interest in this country around trafficking, which is really, really exciting. The downside is that it's come with a flavor of sensationalism. This is what we're being offered in the media, okay? Girls in handcuffs, girls bleeding. And one of the things that we've learned from the domestic violence movement, right, is if you think back to what DV images looked like originally, it was a woman with a black eye and battered. And what the DV community learned quickly is that if that's what we're presenting is domestic violence, then when a woman walks in, she doesn't look like that. And it's very easy for law enforcement, for service providers to just dismiss their victimization. We're replicating the same thing here. This is what's being seen as trafficking and what it looks like. And I am here to tell you that the girls that we serve, their handcuffs are so much more frequently a really complicated mixture of love and fear. And frankly, when they have been handcuffed and bleeding, the recovery is easier because it's easier not to blame yourself. Okay? I couldn't have walked away. I was cuffed, as opposed to feeling like you could have. I want to offer some alternate images. Girls in our program can graduate into our leadership corps, in which they are paid to work with us and to work on the movement to end exploitation. And about a year and a half ago, our leadership corps did a photojournalism exhibit called Through Our Eyes, in which they went all over to kind of tell their stories, or a piece of their stories. And the exhibit has been at our city hall, at the state house. And this particular picture I love. It's, and I've changed names, of course. Maria's story is that her home growing up was one in which there was addiction and there was violence. Her dad hurt her. Her dad hurt her mom. Her mom coped by getting high. So she was really on her own. And when a peer in her seventh grade class said, well, you can live with me and my mom, she went. And she stayed with that young boy and his mom, and that mom took care of her emotionally and physically and fed her and clothed her. And then at some point along the way said, well, you owe me. And drove her to this hotel, which is on the North Shore of Mass, and sold her. And she went back at 16 to this hotel for the first time. What I love about her photo is you would be hard-pressed to ever recognize what hotel that is, right? Because it looks like every mid-range hotel in America, and that's the face of what trafficking looks like right now. When we talk about statistics, we don't have any good ones. Next slide, right? And from a public health perspective, it's very, very frustrating. The best study that was done was concluded now this many years ago, 2001. And the best they were able to say is that somewhere between 100,000 and 300,000 girls, boys, and transgender youth were at what they believed to be very high risk of exploitation in any given year. Most of us in the field feel even that 300,000 number is a low ball. It's a low undercount. We don't have any good national statistics at this point. Locally, we have a database here in Suffolk County, which includes the Boston area. We're part of a coalition that began that database in 2005, and since then have been able to identify over 750 young people in that database. That's just skimming the surface, but it begins to let us know who we're seeing and who we're not. So, for example, in that whole database, there are 6 boys, and that's not about it not happening to boys here in Boston. It's that we're not seeing them. The second stat holds pretty true. We know that the most frequent age into the sex industry is 12 to 15 years old. So it's middle school age. And this holds true across the entire country. Before I go on talking about the side of victimization and marginalization, I want to also just make a note around the demand, around who is buying sex from kids. And we know if, let's say we took that estimated 300,000 victims or those to be at high risk, and we know it's much higher than that. And as I said, kids report having exchanged sex 10 to 20 times per night. So if you do the math, how many men, and I say men because in this country it's exclusively men who buy sex, how many men are buying sex from kids in this country? Okay, and so when we think from a public health perspective, we have to be addressing that piece as well. What we know about the men who buy sex is that a small number, you know, a sizable but relatively small number meet the DSM criteria for a pedophile, that they're actively looking for a child and looking to do harm, but that the vast majority are what we call situational abusers that are having sex with a child because that's who's available and they can. We know that the vast majority of men who buy sex are white, are middle to upper middle class, live in the suburbs, have a wife, and have children and a good job. Okay, and so as we think about our analysis of exploitation and trafficking, the, you know, as the two speakers ahead talked about, we cannot talk about any of this without lifting up the issues of racism and classism and sexism that are such a piece of this. So when we think about marginalization and risk and vulnerability, which Deborah kind of laid out as a framework, we know that girls are at risk for being recruited if they're under 18, if they have time in their day, they're alone, walking to the school or to the store, if they own or have access to a computer. You know, parents used to feel like we could geographically protect our kids. They don't hang out in places where pimps may recruit. But the reality is that in the past year, almost 50% of our referrals met their perpetrator in either Facebook or in a chat room. So that geographic protection is really much more challenging now. So girls are at risk if they want to fall in love, if they want to take risks, if they feel like their parents don't always understand them, if they feel, sometimes fight with their parents, if they feel lonely, they want more independence. So according to this, who's at risk? Every adolescent girl, right? Because I just described what's normative adolescent development, right? This is normal. And the things that make, or typical is a better word, and the things that are typical for an adolescent girl put her very much at risk. And having said that, we know that some girls are disproportionately at risk. And if we think about the ACEs study, right, it's girls who've had multiple kinds of victimization. In particular, and I forgot to mention, my girls had asked that I include some photographs, and usually in my longer training I include lots of theirs. Laura wanted to make sure you saw her house where she grew up, that it was a little white house with two American flags in it, and wanted to make sure that folks had that visual too when thinking about exploitation. But we know that somewhere between 70 and 90% of girls and women in the life have a history of child sexual abuse. And when we think about the lessons that girls learn if you go up in a house where there's sexual abuse, and I'm talking about us, right, not them, it's one in three or four of us, we learn that we're valued only for sex. We learn that our bodies are not our own. We learn to keep secrets. We learn that you can't trust anybody, that no one can protect you. And these are the very same lessons that pimps want to teach girls and need to teach girls if she is going to do what he or she needs him to do. So we know that pimps actively target kids with this kind of trauma history by actively targeting kids in our child protective services system. Other major risk factors are addiction, not in particular a girl's addiction, because most pimps don't look for girls who are addicts, right? Because you don't look so good when you're actively using. Pimps look for girls that they can ply with a little bit of weed, a little bit of alcohol, but having a mom or dad who's actively using puts her very much at risk. Witnessing domestic violence puts her very much at risk, losing a parent. So we're talking about girls without a safety net being those who are most vulnerable to being exploited. We also know that low-income girls of color are disproportionately targeted, are disproportionately trapped, wind in staying in longer. So how does recruitment happen? We know it happens in a variety of ways. We know that sometimes, you know, one of our girls was new to town. She went to Burger King. She met someone who said, oh, you know, come with my boyfriend. We're going to a party. She got in the car, thought this might be a good way to make friends, and was held against her will all across the state and into Rhode Island with two other girls and made to work. We see coercion. You work for me, or I'm going after your little sister, or with our teen moms. You work for me, or you're not going to see your child. Okay, and those of us who have kids, right, you know you do what you have to do for your kid. We see befriending. One of our girls was, who's an incredible dancer and beautiful and wanted to be a star, and she was promised that she was going to dance in a rap video, and that's, you know, not what happened. And lastly, though, what we see most of the time is seduction, where a pimp will spend as much time as is needed until she is completely and hopelessly in love with him, where she is dependent on him financially, emotionally, physically. And then he'll say, I'm a little short on the rent this month. Can you help me out just this once? You know, that kind of scenario. And literally, I've heard that same story over and over again across the country. And once she does this once, he has her in a cycle that's very similar to domestic violence, where she doesn't know if she'll be hurt or she'll be loved. The impact is profound and severe. It impacts our young people, mind, body, and soul. One of the most profound things that we fight against is this idea of this being a victimless crime. No harm, no foul. She's getting her needs met. She was smiling. She got some money, and I got my needs met. And that's not the case. From a public health perspective, the violence, the rapes, the risk of STIs, including HIV. We have no numbers on HIV seroprevalence in this country for our girls. Very high rates of addiction over time, because kids learn that it's one of the ways to survive this, right? If you get high, it's actually a very effective way to survive it for a period of time. Many psychological impacts. We see a lot of girls have developed dissociative disorders as they learn to dissociate to survive. And very, very high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder among the girls we serve. And the other piece I'd add is the spiritual piece, this sense of despair and hopelessness that is so profound. So how do we recognize these girls? And we could go into a whole piece, but there isn't time. I have 4 minutes, right? Okay. I'm going five. We could talk about the different kind of indicators to look for. And if you're serving young people, I really urge you to get that kind of training and know that lens. In the same way, those of us who've been in the field a while, right, you were trained in a lens around domestic violence. You were trained in a lens around substance abuse, even around depression, so that when you sit with a young person, you feel it in your bones before you start going through a criteria, right? You start to think, oh, something's going on here. I need to, all right, now I'll do an assessment. The idea is you got to develop that same lens around this so that something doesn't fit right for you. The other piece is that I urge folks for in the programs where you work or the programs you advise that you ask the question, have you ever had to exchange sex for money, food, shelter, or drugs? That simple. What I hear over and over again from my girls and from our staff is made up of women who've survived this. They didn't tell because you didn't ask. They didn't think adults could handle this information. They thought it was too dark, it was too shameful, and unless you open the door by asking, they were not going to tell. So the process that we are invested in and the process of recovery, what it looks like is that movement from victim to survivor. But we believe that there's another step after that, which is from survivor to leader. And whether or not that means leadership in the movement to end exploitation or leadership in which you find your voice in other areas of your life, but that's the most profound piece of recovery. And so what's emerging as best practices around the country is first and foremost training, making sure that any program you work with that interfaces with adolescent girls is trained on this. It should be one of the requirements for any public health-funded program, any violence prevention program, any rape crisis prevention program. We mandate a lot of other kinds of training. Folks need to be trained in this because the difference, it's an immediate impact, right? You train folks, and then they look at young people differently, and then they make referrals to the services they need. And along with that is prevention. So we have a 10-week prevention curriculum that's in 22 states at this point, but increasing that real focus. A coordinated multidisciplinary response. We feel really strongly about working in close relationships with law enforcement. You know, I'm very clear that I'm not armed. I'm not right now. I don't know about the rest of you, but I am not armed right now. And that there's times that's needed. I was on the phone yesterday with a young woman we work with who fled a dangerous situation. But when she left all of her documents in this house. And she said to me on the phone, I'm going to go back in there, like when it's late, and get my stuff. And I said, no, stay exactly where you are, and I'm going to find some good cops to go with you. And in fact, when I talked to the law enforcement in this one town, they said, oh, that house? We know that guy. I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse. And sure enough, within a half hour, the guy who ran the house dropped everything off at the police station for her. So that importance of having law enforcement partners, of having partners in the medical field, of having partners in child protective services, so that the safety net is woven. We feel really strongly about survivor-led interpersonal support. There's so much that those of us who are not survivors can do to support somebody in their recovery, but the piece of hope, that immediate hope, when you meet someone who looks like you, who's been in that dark place you were in, but look at where they are now, and they're standing on their feet, and they're making a living, and they can hold their head up, it is the most profound thing that girls will say impacted them. So making sure that's there. Investing in long-term recovery. So many of our programs are timed, and okay, we're going to give you 6 months of services. We're going to call that support and stabilization, right? I mean, one of the things we feel strongly about in our program is we fundraise all the time, which I was not trained to do in public health school, but it's a huge part of my job, so that we serve girls as long as they want support. And the truth is that's 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, because that's what recovery looks like. It's three steps forward and two steps back. And lastly, making sure that there are referrals that are trauma-informed, that understand exploitation around appropriate placement, around appropriate treatment, and this piece around finding your own power and finding your own voice. So in sum, I have a half a minute. All right, I'll be okay. All right, thank you. Again, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. This is just a snapshot. Please do email me with additional questions or wanting to connect and be involved. If you want to stay kind of connected to what's happening in the movement, please like us on Facebook, because it's one of the easiest ways to stay in touch with folks. But I hope that folks can kind of lift this up as one of many marginalized populations in our communities, but one that's been dehumanized, ignored, and it's our responsibility to see it and no longer co-sign it. Thank you. Wonderful.